Welcome to another episode of The Mochi Takes, transmissions from the last frontier.
Yes.
If you've been with us on this journey so far, you know exactly where we've been standing. You and I, we've been shoulder to shoulder inside this incredibly dusty, freezing, just totally forgotten little cabin deep in the woods of the Girdwood Valley in Alaska.
Oh, the dust and the cold. You can almost feel it.
You really can. We have spent hours poring over that cardboard box of cassette tapes. And what we found on those magnetic ribbons, recorded back in, what was it, 1996 through 1998?
Yeah, 96 to 98.
Right. We found a voice, Mochi. He was this enigmatic pirate radio DJ broadcasting on 88.5 FM Glacier City Radio. And we listened as he spoke into a microphone from literally a nylon tent out in the wilderness.
Or sometimes from the turret of that quirky local house, yeah.
Exactly. And we heard him spin this wild, eclectic mix of music, read these dense interpretations of Mayan astrology, and fiercely critique the, you know, alienating, soul-crushing nature of industrial capitalism.
He was a guy searching, almost desperately at times, I think, for a sense of cosmic consciousness.
A true child of the underground counterculture, looking for meaning while shivering in the last great wilderness.
It really was a remarkable time capsule. Those tapes captured a very specific ethos of the late 90s, that deep DIY, anti-establishment, fiercely nomadic spirit.
Mm-hmm.
Mochi was, by all definitions, living entirely on the fringes of mainstream society. He was surviving the harsh Alaskan elements, relying heavily on community mutual aid, and using his pirate radio platform to beam out this localized frequency of love, liberation, and spiritual purification.
It felt like we were analyzing an artifact from a lost civilization.
It did, or at least a lost way of being, a snapshot of ghosts.
A snapshot of a ghost. That is exactly how it felt. Like, close, finished.
Yay.
You listen to a guy broadcasting from a tent in 1997 about the Mayan calendar, talking about portals and cosmic energy, and you kind of just assume he eventually faded into the Alaskan snowdrift.
Yeah, you think the trail goes cold the moment the cassette tape runs out.
But here is the massive, mind-blowing twist of this entire investigation.
I love this part.
The trail did not go cold. Mochi didn't vanish. We found his digital footprint.
We really did.
We discovered a sprawling, meticulously maintained family website, MochiAndColleen.com, and it documents nearly 30 years of his life, stretching all the way from those pirate radio days up to right now.
Right now.
We are talking up to this exact moment in time, July 30, 2026.
Which presents us with a completely unprecedented analytical opportunity. Because in studying this archive, we get to answer what is arguably the ultimate question of the underground counterculture.
What happens when they grow up?
Exactly. What actually happens to a fiercely independent, nomadic, anti-capitalist, pirate radio spiritualist when they have to grow up?
Yeah.
How does someone carrying that intense, uncompromising philosophical weight navigate the transition from the 20th century into the 21st? The shift from physical cassette tapes to digital web servers holds the key to understanding how his ideology either survived, mutated, or, you know, completely transformed over three decades.
I want to dive straight into that transition.
Yeah.
Because the whiplash from the 90s Alaskan wilderness to where we pick up the story is staggering.
It's massive.
So we jump forward a few years from the end of the tapes. It's 2005, less than a decade removed from the Girdwood cabin. But Mochi is no longer alone in a tent talking to the stars.
No, he is not.
By 2005, he is relocated to South Hadley, Massachusetts. He is with his partner, Colleen. They've settled there specifically to be near Mochi's older son, Galen, and they are actively preparing for the birth of a new baby.
Ambiana, who arrives in January of 2006.
Right. So in the blink of an eye, the solitary, shivering wilderness wanderer is a family man in New England.
And that is the exact moment where you'd expect the narrative to flatten out, isn't it?
Oh, totally.
The classic trope is that the rebel has a child, compromises their ideals for stability, and immediately conforms to a stationary suburban life. The white picket fence, the 9-to-5 job, the complete abandonment of the nomadic ethos.
But that is not the path they take.
Not at all. Instead of retreating inward into domestic isolation, Mochi and Colleen take this fragile, newly formed family unit and they completely externalize it.
They really do.
By 2007, they take Ambiana, who we need to remember is just an infant at this point, and they hit the road for a massive coast-to-coast adventure.
Right. And we need to be clear about what this means. This isn't packing a minivan for a weekend at a local campground.
No.
This is an epic, grinding RV journey across the continent. The blog chronicles them driving through Joshua Tree National Park, pulling off onto public land.
Yeah, that post is beautiful.
Mochi writes about stepping out into the absolute darkness of the desert and watching the Milky Way wheel overhead, just like he used to do in Alaska, but now he's holding a baby.
It's such a striking image.
And then they navigate the brutal concrete suburban sprawl of Phoenix. Mm-hmm. They push through to Chicago just to celebrate Colleen's 31st birthday. And the sheer logistical reality of that, doing that with diapers, with a crying infant, living in the cramped swang box of an RV, it's intense.
It is an incredible commitment to an ideal. They are refusing to let the logistical weight of parenthood anchor them to a single zip code. And they don't stop at the edge of the North American continent either. They eventually go global. They take a toddler backpacking in Fiji.
Fiji. Okay, this is where I really had to pause and digest what I was reading.
Right.
Taking a toddler on a backpacking trip through the South Pacific sounds borderline impossible. Like, how does that even work when your entire worldview is anti-consumerist?
It's tricky.
You can't exactly avoid the global capitalist machine when you're buying international plane tickets.
Yeah.
Is it really possible to maintain an anti-capitalist, fiercely independent lifestyle when you have an infant relying on you for survival?
Well, let's look at the mechanics of the Fiji trip, because it's deeply revealing. They are not staying in all-inclusive, sanitized luxury resorts. They are out in the elements navigating local infrastructure.
Right.
There is a very telling entry in the blog where they are trying to catch a local ferry, but the ferry is delayed for an entire day. Why? Because a group of wealthy tourists chartered it for their own private use. So Mochi, Colleen, and little Ambiana are essentially stranded, forced to spend an extra night on the island of Tavuyuni.
That is such a stark collision of worlds.
Yeah.
You have Mochi, the guy who spent the 90s railing against the hoarding of resources and the greed of civilization, sitting on a dock with his toddler because someone with a massive checkbook just bought the public transit out from under them for the day.
Precisely. And how do they react? They don't have a meltdown. They adapt.
Yeah.
They end up hiking into the interior of the island to find a natural water slide. And when they finally do get on the ferry the next day, Mochi writes this incredibly tender observation about sitting on the deck with Ambiana, who, again, is barely more than a baby, and teaching her how to play the card game Go Fish, just to pass the time on the open water.
The juxtaposition is wild. You're navigating the South Pacific on a bumpy, delayed local ferry, and you're just doing the most mundane, universal parenting task imaginable, teaching a kid a card game. But there's another moment in Fiji that I want to pull out, because it really speaks to how they're raising this child. They are on the coast, and Colleen decides she wants to go see kayaking.
Oh, this part is intense.
The local operators won't rent her a kayak unless she takes a local guide, a guy named Carlos. Mochi mentions he's totally fine with this because he had read previous travelers' journals specifically thanking these guides for literally saving their lives in the rough water.
Which is a very pragmatic, grounded approach to risk.
Very. So Colleen and Carlos paddle out. Mochi and little Ambiana stay on the shore, hiking along the coastal trail. Mochi is watching them from the cliffs. They paddle out past the safety of the reef, and suddenly, they're completely swallowed up by these massive, towering ocean swells.
It's just completely dwarfed by the water.
Colleen writes later that she had never seen seas so big, and the current was terrifyingly strong. She's out there battling the open ocean in a tiny piece of plastic. And Mochi's on the shore, holding his child, just watching this happen.
It's a powerful image. And if we want to understand the why of this lifestyle, we have to look at moments like that.
What do you mean?
Well, a traditional suburban parenting model is often based on risk mitigation, right?
Right.
Shielding the child, creating a perfectly safe, temperature-controlled environment. Mochi and Colleen are doing the exact opposite. They are embracing calculated risk and deep, visceral immersion in the rawness of the natural world.
Yeah, that makes sense.
They aren't hiding the power of the ocean from Ambiana. They are showing it to her. They are demonstrating that the world is huge and sometimes dangerous, but you engage with it anyway.
Okay, yeah. It's like an experiential education. And that education continues when they leave Fiji and head to New Zealand. Because, again, they aren't just being tourists. They actively seek out labor.
Yes.
They go live and work on organic farms, specifically a place called Aroha Organics in a town called St. Andrews. And then, and this is maybe my favorite anecdote from this era, they attend the Canaan Downs New Year's Festival.
Yes, the Canaan Downs Festival. This is where the ideological rubber really meets the road.
Totally. So this is a massive 5-day, techno and reggae music festival out in the New Zealand wilderness. Mochi and Colleen want to go. But instead of just logging on and buying VIP passes with a credit card like a normal consumer, they figure out a back door.
They volunteer.
Yeah. They volunteer to be part of the waste management team in exchange for their tickets. They literally trade their physical labor, managing the garbage and the recycling for thousands of people for the right to dance to techno beats under the stars.
And we have to stop and analyze the mechanism of that choice, because this directly answers your earlier question about how they justify international travel while maintaining an anti-capitalist mindset.
Right.
Pure, unadulterated independence from the system, living completely without money or global infrastructure, is virtually impossible when you have dependence. You cannot barter your way onto a Boeing 747.
Right. The airline doesn't want your handmade jewelry. They want currency.
Exactly. So what Mochi and Colleen are demonstrating here is intentionality within the system. They aren't eschewing money altogether, but they are radically rethinking how they exchange their time and labor.
Mm.
By choosing to sort trash for festival tickets, they are actively circumventing the standard consumer transaction. They are prioritizing raw experience over the accumulation of capital.
So they are navigating the capitalist machine, but only to extract the resources necessary to facilitate this nomadic worldly education for their child.
Yes. It's a compromise, undeniably. But it's a fiercely negotiated one. If you look back at Mochi's 1990s radio broadcasts on Glacier City Radio, a huge theme was escaping urban alienation and seeking authentic, cooperative human connection.
He called it being a world bridger.
Exactly. What we are seeing in New Zealand, sorting trash to listen to reggae, is that he didn't abandon his macro vision. He just scaled it.
Mm.
He turned his sweeping global ideology into a highly functional micro community. His family became the tribe he was searching for in the Alaskan woods.
That is a fascinating way to look at it. Scaling the ideology down to the size of a family unit. But you know, you can only live out of a backpack and an RV for so long. Eventually, the sheer logistics of moving a growing child across the planet force you to make a choice about stability.
And they round out the trip living in Hawaii for a bit before making that choice.
Right, Hawaii. But then the choice they make in 2008 completely flips the script of everything we've seen so far. They decide to put down roots.
And this transition back to a stationary life is documented with the exact same raw, unvarnished honesty as their global travels. They don't try to make it look glamorous.
Definitely not.
In September of 2008, the global road trip winds down. They touch down in San Francisco, make their way back east, and eventually rent a house in Vermont.
And the reality of renting a house after roaming the earth is just so gritty. The very first thing they have to do when they move into this rental in Vermont is bomb the house for fleas. Twice.
Oh, man.
Because the previous tenant's dog left a massive infestation in the carpets.
It's a harsh welcome back to the stationary world.
It really is. And they don't have anything. They are slowly, painstakingly acquiring the basic building blocks of a domestic life. A couch, a kitchen table, a bookshelf.
Mm.
But the DIY ethos is still burning so bright.
Very much so.
There's this beautiful detail where Mochi is building these elaborate three-story dollhouses for Ambiana out of cardboard boxes.
Mm.
He's not going to a big box store and buying plastic toys. He's taking the literal packaging of the consumer world and repurposing it into architecture for his daughter.
Which is a perfect metaphor for what they do next.
Oh, yeah.
Because renting a flea-infested house is just a holding pattern. The real anchor drops in 2011. This is the monumental shift. They pool their resources and purchase a raw piece of land at 472 Eagle Ledge Road in Vermont.
Okay, stop right there. Because this is where I hit a massive mental roadblock when I was reading the blog, and I really need you to help me untangle it.
Sure.
We are talking about the guy who spent the entire autumn of 1997 on the radio, quoting esoteric astrology to critique the insidious greed of civilization. The guy who warned his listeners about the soul-crushing nature of property, borders, and ownership. This same guy goes to a bank, signs a deed, and becomes a landowner. Doesn't that fundamentally break the spell? I mean, did he just sell out, or did he just build his own private utopia?
Well, it certainly looks like a contradiction on the surface, doesn't it? I grappled with that exact same question.
It's hard to reconcile.
It feels like a betrayal of the pirate radio ethos.
Mm.
But when you really dig into why they bought the land, and more importantly, what they did with it, it becomes much more complex.
Okay, so untangle it for me.
Yeah.
Because right now I'm seeing a guy who raged against the machine, buying a plot of land inside the machine.
I think we have to look at the ultimate paradox of modern counterculture. If you want to exist completely outside the system of property ownership, What does that actually look like in the 21st century?
Renting.
It usually means living entirely at the mercy of others. You are renting from a landlord, you are squatting precariously, or you are living a transient lifestyle that becomes increasingly dangerous and unstable as you age, especially with children.
Yeah, you're always vulnerable to being moved along by someone with more power.
Exactly. You have no sovereignty. I think Mochi realized that to create a truly stable, autonomous environment for his children, a place where they could dictate their own relationship with nature, generate their own resources, and live outside the constant hum of consumerism, he needed a sovereign base of operations. He didn't buy a house in a subdivision to build equity or speculate on real estate. He bought raw dirt to remove his family from the consumer supply chain as much as humanly possible. It's not about buying into the system. It's about securing a perimeter so you can build your own micro-utopia inside it.
Securing a perimeter. I like that. It reframes the deed to the land, not as a surrender, but as a defensive wall.
Yes.
And they absolutely needed a wall because what they do inside that perimeter for the next 10 years is staggering. The purchase of Eagle Edge Road kicks off a literal decade of relentless, grueling physical labor.
And we really need to emphasize the physical toll of this. The blog entries over the next decade detail the construction of two primary structures on the property, the winter house and the longhouse.
From the ground up.
From the ground up. And Mochi and Colleen aren't hiring general contractors or pouring concrete from a fleet of trucks. They are living in a cramped trailer on the raw land while they build these structures with their own hands.
I was exhausted just reading about it. The sheer scope of the labor is insane. They are digging trenches. They are framing walls. They are laying intricate tile surrounds in the bathrooms themselves. And the weather. Reading through the archives, you get this visceral, bone-deep sense of the Vermont mud seasons.
Which is a very specific kind of misery.
Right. Mud season in Vermont isn't just a few puddles. It's the fifth season. It's when the deep frost finally heaves and thaws, and the dirt roads turn into impassable, sucking bogs.
It's brutal.
They are completely isolated. They are battling the elements constantly. They are surviving deep, sub-zero freezes in a trailer, waiting for the spring thaws, battling floods that wash out their access. It feels so much like Mochi battling the Alaskan winters back in the tent, except now he's responsible for a family.
And during all of this intense survival and construction, their family grows. Jacoby is born, and by our current timeline in 2026, he is turning 16. So you have two kids growing up in the middle of this massive, ongoing homesteading project.
Yeah, the projects never stop.
Never. They're boiling sap. They install a sauna.
Even as recently as 2023, Mochi is out there building a massive, elaborate treehouse on the property. But the most fascinating project, structurally speaking, is the power grid. They don't just string a wire to the nearest utility pole. They build their own micro-hydro projects to generate electricity.
Oh, this is such a cool detail.
Okay, I am so glad you brought this up because we need to explain how this actually works. When I first read micro-hydro, I pictured like a giant Hoover Dam scenario. But it's not that at all, is it?
Not at all. It's incredibly localized engineering. Essentially, if you have a creek or a stream on your property with a decent change in elevation, which they do in the Vermont Hills, you can harness that flowing water.
Okay, how?
You divert a small portion of the stream into a pipe, which is called a penstock. As the water travels down the pipe, gravity builds up pressure, which is called head. At the bottom of the hill, that highly pressurized water is forced out of a nozzle and it strikes a small turbine, spinning it rapidly.
Wow.
That turbine is connected to an alternator, which generates electricity that feeds into a battery bank.
Wait, so as long as the creek is flowing, you have power.
Exactly.
You are entirely decoupled from the coal plants and the corporate grid.
Exactly. And the philosophical symmetry here is just beautiful. I want to connect this micro-hydro turbine directly back to the 1997 pirate radio broadcasts.
Okay, we'll do it.
In Alaska, Mochi physically built his own media platform out of a house turret. He strung up copper wire antennas in the trees. He bypassed the entire corporate media structure to create his own independent signal.
He generated his own frequency.
Yes. And in Vermont, he's doing the exact same thing, just with a different medium. He is applying that identical independent impulse to concrete, timber, and flowing water instead of radio waves.
That's amazing.
He built his physical world block by block, turbine by turbine, just as he built his radio show track by track. The medium changed from audio to infrastructure, but the message of total independence remained exactly the same.
That is profound. The infrastructure is the ideology. And as they put down these physical roots into the Vermont mud, they also begin to put down these deep, deep spiritual roots.
Definitely.
And this is where we start to see how his intense, almost chaotic astrological focus from the 90s evolved into something incredibly grounding over the course of 30 years.
Let's contextualize that, because the contrast is striking. On the old Glacier City radio tapes, we spent hours listening to Mochi broadcast these dense, solitary reflections on esoteric systems. He would talk endlessly about the 13-moon calendar.
Right, which for anyone who doesn't remember is this alternative Mayan-inspired calendar system that tries to sync human perception of time with natural cosmic cycles instead of the artificial mechanical months of the Gregorian calendar.
Exactly. It's a complete rejection of standardized time. And he would talk about the energetic shifts of blue electric storms, which is a specific signature in that calendar symbolizing activation and radical change.
I remember those broadcasts.
He would theorize about using cosmic portals to foster collective consciousness. It was heavily abstract, it was highly theoretical, and most importantly, it was largely solitary.
Yeah, just him and the mic.
He was sitting alone in the dark, talking to an invisible audience. But when we look at the modern family blog, we see something entirely different. We see how those abstract cosmic philosophies have been translated into physical, communal, tangible family rituals.
It's no longer just a guy in a tent talking about the stars. It becomes physical action. The blog is full of these traditions. They track the current moon phases right on their website homepage.
It's built right into the UI.
They celebrate the winter solstice every single year without fail, bringing in a winter tree to mark the darkest day of the year. They celebrate Imbolc in February and Beltane in May, honoring the exact mathematical turning points of the agricultural and cosmic year.
They're deeply intentional about it.
Every autumn, they host a massive ancestor feast. They even created this weird, joyful, annual family staple called the Spring Equinox Egg Hunt and Toss.
And we have to ask why these specific rituals matter so much. What Mochi successfully did was take the abstract love vibration he used to preach about on the radio and manifest it into memory for his children. He recognized something fundamental about modern life. Industrial capitalism operates on a very specific, rigid, mechanical rhythm. The five-day work week, the fiscal quarters, the commercialized holidays designed entirely to drive retail sales.
The machine's heartbeat.
Precisely. And Mochi entirely rejected that heartbeat. By celebrating Imbolc and tracking the moon, he created an alternative rhythm to time itself for his family. He aligned his children's lives with the natural, cyclical world that he so deeply revered in his youth, rather than the linear, profit-driven calendar of the dominant culture.
And the connective tissue through all of this, through the mud, the construction, the solstices, is the music.
Oh, always the music.
The music never stopped. But the way he experiences it totally shifted. He traded spinning CDs alone in a freezing cabin for immersive live folk music. By the time we hit the summer of 2026, the blog notes that Mochi has attended the Falcon Ridge Folk Festival for 21 years.
21 consecutive years. That is a staggering level of continuity.
It is. The documentation of Falcon Ridge on the blog is just incredible. It clearly becomes the emotional and communal anchor of their entire year. Mm-hmm. They don't just show up. They build a highly organized base camp.
Yeah, it's not a casual trip.
Mochi details how he cooks all of his meals for the festival on this tiny, hyper-efficient firebox stove. And he doesn't use charcoal or propane. He uses twigs that he meticulously collected and dried before leaving Vermont, just to bring a piece of his homestead to the festival.
And Colleen's role at the festival is equally fascinating. She is in charge of managing the recycling logistics for the entire event.
I had to laugh when I read that, because think about the trajectory. The woman who is battling massive, terrifying ocean swells in a Fijian sea kayak is now commanding the complex waste stream logistics for thousands of folk music fans in a field in New York or Connecticut.
It's that same intense competence just applied to environmental stewardship.
And the sensory details Mochi writes about are so vivid. There's a post about him getting a henna tattoo from a friend named Lili. But it's Mochi, so it's not just a butterfly or a peace sign.
No, it's highly conceptual.
Highly. He asked for a henna tattoo depicting the true Christ as a single-celled organism, which he explains represents the exact evolutionary moment when the raw intelligence of matter first gained agency in the universe. He's walking around a folk festival with amoeba Christ on his arm. And after all this intense dancing and deep spiritual fellowship and henna theology, how do they close out the festival?
They go to a local joint called Dos Amigos and just stuff themselves with Mexican food.
It is the perfect, beautiful blend of the profoundly sacred and the utterly mundane. And if we look at the musical evolution here, the metaphor is undeniable. On the pirate radio, he was a solitary broadcaster sending signals out into the void, hoping, praying, really, that someone out there was listening and resonating.
Yeah, that isolation was so palpable on the tapes.
At Falcon Ridge, he is physically immersed in the crowd. He is in the dance tent doing high-energy contra dances, skin-to-skin with the community, sweating to bands like the Gaslight Tinkers. Essentially, Mochy traded the solitary radio microphone for a crowded contra dance tent.
It's the exact same communal energy, the intense desire for a shared frequency, but now he's experiencing it in person, rather than over the invisible airwaves. He finally found the tribe he was calling out to back in Alaska.
And we have to recognize that the core of that tribe isn't just his friends from the festival circuit. The core of the tribe is his children.
Yes.
Which brings us to a fascinating evolution in the story. Because we have to look at how Mochy and Colleen's intense, intentional lifestyle deeply impacted Ambiana and Jacoby as they grew up. What happens to the kids raised inside the perimeter?
You look at the blog as we move through the late 2010s and into the 2020s, and it is so clear that the kids have totally inherited that wandering experiential spirit. They aren't just sitting in the woods in Vermont playing video games.
No, not at all.
In 2018, they do a massive family backpacking trip through Belize. The blog describes them waking up at dawn, packing onto fast, crowded water taxis, exploring the sleepy, dusty fishing village of Sertanasia, and physically diving into the underground river systems of the Mayan underworld caves.
Just incredible experience.
They are exploring the dense Puerto Rican rainforest. They are traveling to the volcanic landscapes of Iceland.
They're citizens of the world, but grounded in the homestead. And there's a wonderful, deeply domestic entry from a 2023 trip to England. They go to visit Ambiana, who is older now and traveling on her own. And Ambiana cooks them a meal that the family officially dubs La Zambiana.
Oh, that recipe sounded amazing.
I wrote down the recipe details because it sounded so chaotic and amazing. Mochy describes it as the love child of an Italian lasagna and a Mexican enchilada.
Right.
It's lasagna noodles. But they're filled with spinach ricotta and heavily spiced Irish beef and then smothered in sauce and cheese. They eat this massive heavy meal, watch the Disney movie Tangled, and force themselves to stay awake until 11 p.m. just to aggressively adjust their circadian rhythms to the GMT time zone.
It's such an intimate, hyper-specific family memory, but it shows that the kids are now the ones facilitating the experiences. And as we move fully into the 2020s, you see Ambiana and Jacoby really coming into their own, pursuing passions that absolutely echo their parents' energy, but channeled in entirely new ways.
Yeah, Ambiana goes on these massive gap year world trips. She actually becomes a caller for contra dances, physically leading the communal movement her parents love so much.
And Jacoby becomes this incredible, highly engaged athlete and performer. Yeah, she is a fierce competitor.
We are talking gymnastics, figure skating, and get this, she actually wins a state championship with the U32 track and cross country team.
Right, which just feels like a huge pivot from her dad's whole philosophy.
It does, and it really makes me wonder, you know, if embracing state-sanctioned competitive athletics is actually just a teenager's brilliant way of rebelling.
Oh, that is a really good point.
Right, like if your dad is a radically free-spirited off-grid parent, joining a highly structured sports team feels like the ultimate act of defiance.
It definitely looks like rebellion on the surface, but, you know, by providing a radically unstructured environment, Mochy kind of gave Jacoby the ultimate freedom to just opt into discipline. Jacoby is also performing in high school musicals. These kids are thriving. They're deeply engaged with the broader world.
But while the kids are out exploring the physical world, Mochy's relationship with the digital world takes a very interesting, almost regressive turn. He never truly abandoned his life for the microphone. The medium simply evolved.
Right, the podcast.
Between 2017 and 2018, the guy who used to broadcast Mayan prophecies from a freezing turret in Alaska sits down in his hand-built Vermont house and starts recording a Star Trek Discovery podcast.
A Star Trek podcast?
Star Trek podcast. I mean, I guess if you're going to transition from the 13 moon calendar to pop culture, Starfleet is the way to go.
Naturally.
But I have to push back here, because this is the great glaring irony of this entire 30-year investigation. We've established that Mochy spent decades building a life completely outside the mainstream consumerist paradigm. He wants to be present in nature. He wants to boil his own sap and generate his own electricity.
Yeah.
So why the relentless need to broadcast it all? From pirate radio in the 90s to a highly public family blog that meticulously details every single hike, every cardboard dollhouse, every Scrabble win over Colleen, every fossil hunt, to a Star Trek podcast. What drives a guy who lives off-grid in the woods to constantly, obsessively transmit his life to the outside world, even when he's living off-grid in the woods? Isn't that just a different kind of ego?
It is a beautiful, glaring paradox. You have a man who is so deeply rooted in the philosophy of being present, yet he clearly spends an enormous amount of time staring at a glowing screen, formatting JPEGs, writing HTML code, and maintaining server space just to document that presence.
Yeah, why?
But I think if we look closely at human psychology, the drive to broadcast, especially for someone wired like Mochy, isn't necessarily driven by ego or a desire for fame. It is driven by a fundamental existential desire for connection and archive.
Explain that. Because it looks like he's just posting his life for likes.
I don't think he cares about the metrics. He views his life, his family, and his 30-year journey as a work of art. It is a continuous living performance of alternative existence. By documenting the mud, the fleas, the solar panels, and the lasanbiana, he is leaving breadcrumbs in the digital forest.
Breadcrumbs.
He is actively showing the world, look, it is actually possible to live differently. It is possible to build your own house with your own hands, track the cycles of the moon, and raise a loving, functional family entirely outside the traditional paradigm.
So the blog isn't a vanity project. It's an instruction manual.
Exactly. And the Star Trek podcast fits perfectly into this. Think about what Star Trek represents. The USS Discovery is exploring a vast, unknown cosmos in a post-scarcity utopian future where humanity works for the betterment of all, not for capitalist profit.
Oh, that's a great point.
Mochy is exploring his own internal and digital cosmos. He is leaving a transmission for anyone who feels as lost as he did back in 1997. The blog is essentially the longest-running pirate radio show in history. He just swapped out the copper antenna for an IP address.
Leaving breadcrumbs. I absolutely love that framing. He's transmitting a manual for how to live a beautiful, intentional, uncompromising life. And that realization brings us to the final chapter of our investigation, the echoes of the last frontier. Because this story brings us right up to the present day, July 2026.
Summer 2026, Mochy is turning 61 years old.
Wow.
Just think about the sheer mileage on that soul. Mm. And his life today is full, it is grounded, and it is rich with granular detail. The blog tells us he's currently taking the family to the 45th annual Champlain Valley Gem Mineral and Fossil Show in Essex.
Naturally.
He is absolutely geeking out over 100 million-year-old ammonites and fluorescent gems that glow under UV light. The family even joins the Burlington Gem and Mineral Club so they can go on organized fossil hunting field trips together.
And back at the homestead on Eagle Ledge Road, what is the great pirate radio rebel doing? He's finishing the bathroom mirror surround. After more than a decade of grueling construction, he is finally putting the delicate final aesthetic touches on the house he built with his own hands. It is such a quiet, profoundly domestic image.
It is quiet, but then right amidst this peaceful domesticity, the universe delivers the ultimate callback. The profound poetry of this specific moment is staggering.
It really is.
It is July 2026. Mochy is attending the Falcon Ridge Folk Festival. He is sitting at his base camp in Connecticut, probably cooking on his twig stove. But virtually, via a digital Facebook group, he connects with an event happening thousands of miles away in a tiny town called Hope, Alaska.
Hope, Alaska. The exact region where our entire journey began.
Exactly. The Photon Band is playing a gig at a local venue called Creekside in Alaska, and Mochy notes on his blog with this quiet sense of awe that he actually helped throw the Photon Band's very first show at the Hope Social Hall back in the autumn of 1997.
The exact era, the exact timeline of the dusty cassette tapes we analyzed in our very first discussion.
Yes, the timelines collapse into each other perfectly.
That just, it gives me chills. It's like finding the final missing piece of a 30-year-old puzzle that you didn't even realize you were still trying to solve. We spent all this time listening to this isolated, searching, desperate soul on those 1997 tapes, wondering if his philosophy of being a world bridger was just late-night stoner talk to fill the dead air.
Right.
But this connection proves it wasn't. It was a lifelong, continuous project.
Yeah.
The 1997 audio tapes that felt like isolated, dead artifacts are directly, physically, and digitally connected to this 2026 update.
It is the ultimate proof of concept. It proves that Mochy survived the perilous transition from the 20th century into the 21st century without losing a single drop of his core essence. He grew up, he took on the massive responsibilities of parenthood, he engaged with modern technology, he bought land.
But the frequency remained the same.
Yes, the frequency of his soul remained exactly the same. He was actively bridging worlds in a freezing tent in 1997, and he is actively bridging worlds from a folk festival in 2026.
Okay, let's try to wrap our heads around the totality of this incredible 30-year journey. When you step back and look at the sheer volume of life lived here, from shivering in an Alaskan cabin and broadcasting esoteric astrology into the dark, to traveling the South Pacific with a toddler, to hand-building a homestead in the freezing Vermont mud, tracking the moon, generating his own power, raising incredible worldly kids, and meticulously documenting it all for the archive. It is a staggering, overwhelming achievement of intentional living.
It truly challenges our modern default definitions of what constitutes a successful legacy.
It totally does. It upends the whole paradigm.
Yes, which brings us to the next chapter. We are definitely going to be back with another episode because Mochy has just entered a brand new third phase of his life.
He hasn't stopped building. He's just building highly structured systems now.
Exactly. He has recently published 3 books.
Wait, 3 books?
Yeah, 3. And 2 of them are these DIY guides for building a sauna and a hot tub.
Okay, very practical.
Very. But the third one is this deeply esoteric work titled The Periodic Tarot of the Elements.
The Periodic Tarot of the Elements. That is just so Mochy.
Right. And to top it all off, he has just founded a nature-based wellness center called Deep Time VT.
Wow. So he is practically taking the wildness of his Alaskan youth and packaging it into a wellness center.
Yeah, the practical builder and the cosmic DJ are completely merging.
It's incredible. And it leaves me with this final thought, and I want you listening to this right now to really mull this over as you go about your day. We so often think of true counterculture rebellion as something that only happens when you're young, single, and living recklessly on the fringes of society. It's the romantic image of the solitary guy in the tent in Alaska. But looking at the entirety of Mochy's life, you have to ask yourself a much harder question. Is the ultimate, most radical act of rebellion against the modern capitalist world simply raising a loving family in the woods, grounded in the rhythms of nature, entirely on your own terms? Is a family the longest-running pirate radio broadcast into the future?
That is a beautiful question to take with you into the woods.
Keep tracking the moon, friends. We'll catch you on the next transmission.